Welcome back to Coast AM. We are having a good time over here. I hope you are too. So we're going to do a deep dive into the human mind tonight. We are going to be speaking with Dr. Joe Dispenza, New York Times best-selling author, researcher of neuroscience, and has such a passion for teaching others the latest discoveries from neuroscience and quantum physics about how to reprogram our brains. And his latest work on the placebo effect is such a groundbreaking discoveries on how and why we can heal ourselves using our brains and heal everything from illness and to living a more fulfilled life. We're going to talk about the traits of a spontaneous remission that Dr. Joe has discovered in four different traits of spontaneous remissions that are kind of foundational in why someone would create a spontaneous healing. We will be back with Dr. Joe Dispenza in just a minute. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Garr. And my guest is Dr. Joe Dispenza, a New York Times bestselling author, researcher of neuroscience, and he has such an incredible passion for what he teaches. It's about the latest discoveries in neuroscience and quantum physics combined, where it specifically comes to breaking the habit of being ourself. That's one of his titles of his books, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. Evolve Your Brain, The Science of Changing Your Mind. And his most recent is called You Are the Placebo, Making Your Mind Matter. That subtitle has significance, and we were going to talk about that in more in depth in a little bit. Welcome to the show, Dr. Joe. How are you?
Hi, Lisa. How are you? Happy to be
Hi.
with you.
You too. Great to talk to you. I just saw you a week ago, so we get to begin the conversation with the Coast audience and then get into some really good deep stuff all in this whole show.
Excellent.
So let's first of all talk about the I mentioned earlier about the book, You Are the Placebo. Why did you write that book specifically?
Well, I think this is a time in history where people are questioning the nature of reality more and more because we're in an age of information. And several years back, I did quite a bit of research on spontaneous remissions, and I was interested in correlating the typical changes people were making inside of them that started to produce significant changes in their bodies and in their lives. And when I studied the mechanisms and did our research, the next question was if I understand what other people did in order to have some type of biological changes, can we reproduce the changes? And so in the seminars and workshops that we taught around the world, we started seeing profound changes in people's health after a couple of years. And I started thinking about the idea of the placebo. And I thought, well, if you understand the science of how the placebo works, could you teach it even better once you understood the principle? And so if you think about it, how is it that you can give someone a sugar pill, a saline injection, or perform some false surgery or treatment, and a certain percentage of those people will accept, believe, and surrender to the thought without any analysis that they're getting the virtual treatment or pill, and they begin to produce their own pharmacy of chemicals that matches the exact same chemical they think they're taking? So the question became, is it the inert substance that's doing the healing, or is the person healing by thought alone? So then that pill represents a possibility. The person's given a sugar pill as an example. And let's say they're being treated for depression.
Right.
And the placebo studies around depression show that 81% of the people that are in a placebo study that are given a placebo and told they're given an antidepressant, 81% of those people begin to heal without taking anything that's any medication or pharmaceutical. So they're making their own pharmacy of antidepressants, and brain scans actually confirm that it's not just in their mind, it's in their brain.
Oh, they're
So
actually releasing these chemicals.
exactly, they're making their own dispensary, their own pharmacy of chemicals, and that begins the healing process. And so whether you're in a placebo study for depression, whether you're in a placebo study for pain, you make your own morphine or your own endorphins, or inflammation, you make your own anti-inflammatories. Then the question I had was, well, if the pill represents a potential, a possibility, you give someone a pill and they've been conditioned into believing pills make them better, and they begin to take that pill, but the pill then represents a possibility, and if they can begin to become inspired or hopeful or they feel gratitude, when you combine that clear intention with an elevated emotion, it seems to be the combination that begins to cause the body to move out of the past and into a new future reality. So my question was, do you need the sugar pill? Do you need the saline injection? Or can you teach people to combine that clear intention, select the possibility that already exists in the quantum field, and then teach them how to emotionally embrace that future reality before it's made manifest, so that their body, as the unconscious mind, begins to believe it's living in that future in the present moment, and they begin to signal new genes in new ways that begins to change their very body's expression. So you can teach people how to do that without you relying on some known, but they can select an unknown, a possibility, and revisit that unknown enough times until it becomes a known, and we should begin to see the same effects that a placebo actually produces. And over again, our research shows that once you teach people how to do this, they begin to turn that battleship around their health.
It's enough times, meaning how many times, though? Enough times over several weeks, several months? Could it happen? I doubt it could happen over just one try, right?
Well, I mean, think about placebo studies. It's the same thing. And think about a placebo study for depression. The person's being given the placebo for 6 to 8 weeks, and every day that pill is reminding them of getting better. And so as they take that pill, ingest it every single day, they're reminding themselves of a future reality.
They are
And
reaffirming that day.
so, yeah, so we teach people if it takes 6 to 8 weeks to begin to see measurable effects, well, everybody responds at their own level. Then maybe it may take 6 to 8 weeks of changing your internal state. And we use meditation as the model. And the reason being is because we want people to get beyond their analytical minds. And once they begin to move beyond their analytical minds, they can begin to program their brain and body with a much greater degree. So, because a placebo study takes 6 to 8 weeks, and maybe it took a person a few years to develop through lifestyle their condition, it may take some time to turn it around.
Now, you went through this extraordinary experience of an injury that you had, and you managed to use this is, I think, one of the reasons why you are so fascinated with the human mind and have been so important in letting us know about how to make turning our mind into matter. How did you heal your spine specifically with your mind? Big question.
Well, I mean, I think, in order for some of us to wake up, we need a wake-up call. And for me, I was in a triathlon in 1986, and I got the call. I was in a biking portion of a race, and I was making a turn and passing a few bikers. There was a police officer on the corner, and he was waving me on. And as I made the turn to pass these two cyclists, there was a four-wheel drive Bronco going very fast on the course, and I was hit from behind and then catapulted out of my bike, and I wound up breaking 6 vertebrae in my spine. For me, the diagnosis showed that there are bone fragments on my spinal cord and the neural arch, the arch where the spinal cord passed through it, one of the vertebrae was broken like a pretzel. So I had a pretty poor prognosis that
Was
I
this
would
upper or
probably
lower spine?
in the mid spine, from
Mid, okay.
T8 T9, T10, T11, T12, and L1. And when you land on your butt or you land on your back, the blocks, the columns of the vertebrae, they compress, they flatten like a pancake. And when they compress, the volume has to go somewhere, and it went back on to my spinal cord. So the typical procedure for something like that is called the Harrington rod surgery, and that's where they cut off the back parts of your vertebrae. And in my case, it would be from the base of my neck to the base of my spine. And then they screw in these stainless steel rods, and when you screw in the rods, the screws actually cantilever the spinal column off the spinal cord and gives the cord some room. And then they cut you open around the hip, and they take some bone fragments and they paste it over the rods. And I think, if it would had been any other patient, if I was attending a patient and I saw this kind of condition, I probably would have recommended Harrington rods. But this was me. And I wasn't so quick to rush off into the procedure. So after four opinions, and they all were telling, all the doctors were telling me I needed the Harrington rod surgery, I decided against the surgery, and I thought, well, let's see if I can make a change and begin to heal myself. And I made two decisions. The first decision was that I was going to reconstruct my vertebrae in my mind, and when I was happy with the reconstruction, and I was clear that it was exactly how I would wanted it to be,
Visually.
I would surrender that creation to the part of my autonomic nervous system that knows how to do the healing for me. So I would create an image, and when the image was complete, I would surrender it. The second thing I said is I'm not going to let any thought slip by my awareness that I don't want to experience. Sounds really easy, but I went through 6 weeks of absolute hell because I couldn't get my mind to do what I wanted to do. Because I think when we're in crisis, we tend to focus on what we don't want to have happen instead of what we do want to have happen. So, I would start reconstructing my spine and my mind, and then I would think about living in a wheelchair the rest of my life, or should I sell my home, and I'd have to start all over again because the picture wasn't complete. And so it took me quite a bit of time. And because I wasn't going anywhere, I wasn't doing anything, I was basically laying face down. I had plenty of time to work with it, and I think about 6.5 weeks, I started to notice that it was getting easier for me to concentrate. And right around that time, I went through the whole process inwardly without losing my attention. And something felt right. I felt like I hit a tennis ball in a sweet spot. And from that point forward, I started to notice significant changes in my health. I started to notice all of my pain and all of my numbness and all the different symptoms beginning to change dramatically. And the moment I was noticing changes taking place in my body, I started paying attention even more to what I was doing, and I did it with more conviction and more passion. And it just worked. In 10.5 weeks, I was back on my feet, and I was back to my life, and I just made a deal with myself, and that was if I ever was able to heal myself, I'd spend the rest of my life studying the mind-body connection,
Yeah, you
and much
did.
better.
And now, when you were going through that visual of you completely healed, was that process of that meditation or visualization, was how long in length? Was it 20 minutes, 30 minutes? Do you remember?
Oh no, I'll tell you exactly how long it is. I mean, I believe that there's an intelligence within us that's giving us life, that's keeping our heart beating and digesting our food and organizing trillions of functions every single second. And that intelligence is a consciousness, and consciousness is awareness, and awareness is paying attention. So it's observing and paying attention to us. So I reasoned that it was like an observer watching me, and I was going to show it exactly what I wanted. And if I started showing it what I didn't want, or I lost my attention, I'd have to start all over again because the template, the picture, wasn't complete. So I would spend, no kidding, up to 3 hours, reconstructing my spine, and every time I lost my focus, I would start all over again, and then I would get frustrated and then get impatient. And it seemed to be that those emotions tended to diminish my attention span. So In the beginning, it took many, many hours to be able to do it, and I was never satisfied with the way it was done. But I think the process of reminding myself every single day, reproducing the same level of mind, began to assemble neurological circuits, because nerve cells that fire together wire together. And so over time, I began to reconstruct the hardware in my brain. And if you keep revisiting something over and over again, the hardware becomes a software program. It starts to get easier. And so I didn't know what I was doing at the time, but I was increasing my attention span. And at the same time, I was remapping and reorganizing the neurological structures of my brain. And it got easier over time. But in the beginning, the first 6 weeks, I would spend at least 3 hours. And then after 3 weeks, it just took a much less time, because I was able to go through the whole inward process.
And now, I mean, you didn't even know what you know now about the neurons and the visuals of what it looks like, the process that you went through looks like in the brain with the physical, or did you know what that looked like?
I didn't understand it to the degree that I understand it now. I think that, you know, the innocence that I had at the time and my willingness to even try it, was just the right combination to begin to see measurable changes.
So then you, of course, now have completely dived into the subject of spontaneous remissions. Yours wasn't so spontaneous. I mean, it took a whole 6.5 weeks just to until you started. That's a remarkable amount of time. I know people who have had just as severe of an injury and did go through the surgery, and yes, it's still an evolving healing process. So this is, did you classify what you did as a spontaneous remission?
No, I would call it an intentional healing.
Yeah.
Spontaneous remissions are words that we use when you don't understand the process. And in my investigations, after I healed personally, I started thinking about, has anybody else ever done this before? And so that's when I started to travel around the world and interview people that were diagnosed with conditions, and they were treating conventionally or unconventionally. And all of a sudden, in a certain period of time, they started getting better. And I just knew that there was some cause that was producing the effect. And in my studies, I began to realize that there was a very strong element of mind involved in the process. And so that kind of catapulted the whole thing for me.
So then you started to dive into this whole idea. So have you essentially renamed the word spontaneous remission to intentional healing?
I have.
For
I mean,
you,
well, there are
persons.
Certain cases where people have spontaneous remissions that that they're, you know, they have a healing that takes place that, and they have no idea how that happens. But there are also times where people have spontaneous remissions where they make a change in the way they think, they make a change in the way they act, they make a change in the way they emotionally feel, and when they do that, they begin to demonstrate some biological changes. And so I just wanted to make the correlation. I wanted to understand if they were really spontaneous or not. And in many cases, people followed a similar recipe in order to make their body respond.
Okay, so these traits that you extrapolated from the many, many people that you spoke to and your own personal experience is something that I want to dive into. And we're going to get into this a little bit deeper. They're outlined in You Are the Placebo and Making Your Mind Matter is a subtitle of that. But also, there's interesting things that you said about you made a promise to teach this to as many people as you could after you had this incredible experience. And I wonder how many people you interviewed had that same promise, that they went to continue on the work that they learned or made a significant choice during their healing process where they made a promise to teach that choice. And I wonder how much that had to do with their healing and their continued healing. So we're going to explore that answer as well as the other four traits when we come back after the break. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM, and we'll be right back. Hello, welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. My guest is Dr. Joe Dispenza. He was featured in the movie What the Bleep Do We Know as one of the experts in that movie. He has such an incredible approach to bridging the gap between neuroscience and human potential. We just heard his story of how he literally refused his spine with his mind. And we're going to talk about some of the daily habits and the techniques that he used to do that. But first, we're going to be going through these four traits of intentional healing, which he deciphered from many, many people that he interviewed after he himself had this intentional healing experiment. So we will be right back with Dr. Joe Dispenza. This is Lisa Gar on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. My guest is Dr. Joe Dispenza, who has really done such an incredible job of, through his lectures and workshops, of teaching about the gap between neuroscience, what the science is, and what is actually achievable. And there is a science to that very bridge. And his empowering messages, not only from his own personal experience, but has watched many, many people in his workshops create results in front of his eyes. So we were talking before the break about spontaneous remission, which Dr. Joe calls intentional healing. Intentional healing. So what are some of the traits of people that you've found that are common traits, at least four of them, that exist in many, many of the people that you interviewed?
Well, I call them the four pillars of healing because when something happens once in science, that's called an incident. You know, when there's someone's healed of some type of chronic condition or near fatal condition. If you have two people that share a similar condition and they're healed within a relatively similar period of time, that's called a coincidence, you know, when there's a coincidence. But when it starts happening three or four or five or six times, now you're looking at a trend. And anything that has a trend in science or anything that's repeatable, there has to be some type of law. So I started interviewing, I would travel to 17 different countries and interviewed different people that were diagnosed with health conditions. And I wanted to find out what the cause was that was producing that effect. And interestingly, the first thing they all had in common is that they all believed that there was some intelligence living within them. This is the first principle. And then there's nothing mystical to this intelligence. It's the same intelligence that keeps our heart beating and digesting our food and organizing hundreds of thousands of chemical reactions per second in one single cell of our body.
So it's not like a belief in God or anything. It's just the body's own intelligence.
Well, we can call it, some people called it the spirit within, some people called it innate intelligence, but they understood that there was something that was giving them life. And to different degrees, they named it differently, but they understood that this intelligence that was giving them life had an amazing will, had an amazing mind, and they decided that instead of putting all of their attention on things outside of them, they were going to begin to go within, and they were going to begin to make an effort to make contact with this intelligence and give it a plan, give it a template, give it a design, show it exactly what they wanted. And when they felt complete with what they wanted, they would surrender their creation to this mind and allow it to do the healing for them. So it was this delicate balance between having an intention and then surrendering the creation. So intention and surrender seemed to be that razor's edge. So that was the first thing. They acknowledged that there was something within them that was giving them life that would help them in the healing process. The second thing they had in common is that they realized that it was their own mismanagement of their lifestyle, their own mismanagement of their thoughts and feelings that began to create the condition. And it opened up a whole door of, for me, in understanding this concept called stress. And 75 to 90% of every person that walks into a healthcare facility in the Western world walks in because of a stress-related disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, stress is when your body is knocked out of homeostasis. Stress is when your body is knocked out of balance. The stress response is what your body innately does to return itself back to order. And all organisms in nature can tolerate short-term stress. If a deer is being chased by a pack of coyotes and the deer outruns the coyotes, 15 minutes later, when the stress is over, her body moves back into balance and she starts grazing again, and the event is complete. Well, we have different types of stress. We have physical stress, like traumas and accidents and injuries and falls. We have chemical stress, like viruses and bacteria and hormones and food and pesticides and pollutants and
chronic
blood sugar levels.
Chronic stress.
Yeah, exactly. And then we have emotional stress, like family tragedies, traffic jams, internet connections, second mortgages, single parenting, 401ks, finances. And each one of these physical, chemical, and emotional stresses, the body is knocked out of balance in the same way, but that innate mechanism tends to return the body back to balance. The problem with human beings is that we can turn on that stress response just by thought alone. We can begin to anticipate some future worst-case scenario, and we can attend to that thought to the exclusion of everything else, and we begin to produce the same chemicals in our body as if the event was occurring. Or we can unfold the past bitter memory that's tattooed in the recesses of our gray matter, and like magic, we can bring it to life. And in that moment, it's real, and we begin to produce the very pharmacy of chemicals then that begins to cause the body to move out of balance by thought alone. Now, it's a scientific fact that when you turn on the stress response and you can't turn it off, now you're headed for disease. And the majority of people in the Western world, the psychological and emotional stress tends to be the one that keeps us out of balance. So then, if you understand that the hormones of stress dysregulate or downregulate genes, push the genetic buttons that create disease, and you understand that we can turn on the stress response just by thought alone, then it means that our thoughts can literally make us sick. So the question is if our thoughts can make us sick, can our thoughts make us well?
Mm-hmm.
And so these people began to reason that it was their own mismanagement, their very thoughts and feelings and behaviors that started the condition. And it may have taken them 4 or 5 years of a poor lifestyle that finally set the condition up. And the research shows that less than 5% of people are born with genetic conditions like Tay-Sachs disease or sickle cell anemia,
really?
Type 1 diabetes.
Less than 5%.
The other 95% is created really by lifestyle and habits and behaviors. So they became aware that they were thinking certain thoughts that were producing certain chemicals in their brain that released other chemicals that began to signal their body. In other words, every time you have a thought, you make a chemical. And if you have a great thought, you make chemicals that make you feel great. If you have an unworthy thought, you make chemicals that make you feel unworthy. If you have a fearful thought, you make chemicals that signal your body to begin to feel fear.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you begin to feel those chemicals, because the brain is always monitoring the internal state of the body, we tend to think more thoughts equal to that emotional state. So then we think more fearful thoughts. We think more unworthy thoughts. We think more insecure thoughts, which then makes more chemicals for us to feel that way. And the repetition of thinking and feeling and feeling and thinking over time begins to condition the body to subconsciously remember that emotion as well as the conscious mind. And once the body becomes the mind, that's called a habit. And 95% of who we are by the time we're 35 years old is a set of memorized behaviors, emotional reactions, unconscious habits, beliefs, and perceptions and attitudes that function just like a subconscious computer program. So then by the time we're 35 years old, we're on autopilot. So they began to realize that they had to break the habit of being themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this natural faculty in neuroscience. It's called metacognition. The fact that we can think about what we're thinking about, the fact that we can pay attention to how we're acting, we can notice how we're feeling, means we could modify our states to do a better job in life. And so they had to light a match in a dark place and begin to look at their unconscious thoughts, their unconscious behaviors, and the emotions that were connected to their past experiences. And we say now that your personality creates your personal reality.
I love that phrase. Yes, yes.
And your personality is made up of how you think, how you act, and how you feel. So the present personality who's listening on this call has created the present personal reality called their life, which means then if you want to create a new life, a new personal reality, you got to start thinking about what you've been thinking about and change it. Become aware of your unconscious habits and behaviors and modify them. And look at the emotions that primarily keep us anchored and connected to the past and decide if those emotions belong in our future. And I think most people try to create a new personal reality as the same personality.
Oh,
it doesn't work.
They try to do
literally
something
have to
different,
talk to someone else.
But they have to, oh, they have to truly change their inner environment as well as whatever physically they change in their outer environment, right?
Exactly. So they took responsibility for the whole process, and they stopped blaming their mother or their ex-husband. They stopped blaming, you know, conditions in their past that seemed to alter them. And this is an interesting thought because our brain is organized to reflect everything we know in our life. Our brain primarily is a record of the past. It's an artifact of all the things we've learned and experienced to date. And feelings and emotions are the end product of past experiences, and we can remember experiences better because we can remember how they feel. So if you're feeling the same way every single day, that means nothing new is happening in your life. And if those feelings are driving certain thoughts, and those thoughts are making the same chemicals for you to feel the same way, as long as that emotion is familiar, then your body literally is living in the past. And you can't create a new future holding on to the emotions of the past. So people had to look at the events in their life that may have branded them emotionally, that caused them to change biologically. And they had to begin to look at those emotions and begin to unmemorize them and begin to lower the volume to them. And because emotions are the end product of experiences, then they had to literally overcome their emotional states. And the hormones of stress create the emotions of anger and aggression and hatred and frustration and impatience and fear and anxiety and vigilance and insecurity and guilt and shame and unworthiness. Those are all created by the hormones of stress. And psychology calls that normal states of consciousness. Those are altered states of consciousness.
That's true. It is slightly, it is normal, apparently, you know, according to psychologists, it would be, because that's what they would see. That's all they would see.
Well, the interesting thing about it is that if you study stress in detail, the moment you perceive some threat in your external environment, real or imagined, you are going to begin to mobilize enormous amounts of energy for that threat in your external environment. The moment your sympathetic nervous system turns on and you mobilize all of this energy, the very chemicals of stress cause your senses to become heightened, and we become materialists. We define reality by putting all of our attention on the outer world because that's where the danger is. Turns out if you keep turning on that mechanism and you keep mobilizing all this energy for some threat in your external environment, you have no energy in your internal environment for growth and repair, no energy for long-term building projects, and the body begins to tap its natural resources, and the immune system and all other systems begin to become compromised. So then it makes sense then if you have a hurricane passing through your community, you're not going to want to remodel your kitchen.
Right.
And that's exactly how it works in the body. If we're living in that state where we're in constant vigilance and in constant stress and we're anticipating the future and the worst-case scenario based on our past, we become like junkies. We start to crave those very stress hormones because they give us that rush that makes us feel alive. And And so then people become very
Addicted to
consumed.
stress.
They become very addicted to the very chemicals of stress. And an addiction is something you can't stop. So if you're angry and you're upset, or if you're sad and you're in pain, and you can't change that emotional state, well, an addiction means if you can't stop it on some level, the body has become the mind, the servant has become the master. So these people began to realize that they had to make some very strong fundamental changes within them. And they didn't know what they were doing at the time, but they started forgiving, they started surrendering, they started letting go, they started realizing that justified or not, valid or not, that the very stress hormones were actually making them sick. And so they began the process of changing their internal state. So that was the second thing that
Did
they had in
they
common.
now when they when you said they surrendered, is there a difference between surrendering and not caring anymore, becoming apathetic, unhooked by it all?
Okay, well, let me rephrase that. They began to become so conscious of when they were feeling unworthy, so conscious of when they felt anger or fear, that the moment they became familiar with or conscious of that emotional state, and they could observe it, it meant they were no longer the program. They were the consciousness observing themselves, and they began to objectify their subjective self. In other words, the moment they could observe themselves, they were no longer the old self. They were viewing themselves from a greater level of mind. And so they began to pull out of the program in a sense, and by becoming that conscious of it, they began to unmemorize those emotions and lower the volume, really, and they began to liberate that emotion out of their body. And then that's when they started to notice some significant
That
changes. So
doesn't
that's
sound
the
like
second thing.
apathy to me. That doesn't sound like not caring to me. Yeah. But there is
Yeah, it's
definitely a
not like a,
difference.
yeah, it's not like a surrender like they gave up. I don't mean that. I mean surrender it like they gave up living by that emotional state. In other words, you have an experience in your life. It happens 25 years ago, and it causes you to feel fear. It causes you to feel anger. It causes you to feel insecurity. It causes you to feel guilt. Well, when people say to you, "Why are you that way?" you would say, "I am this way because of this event that has happened to me 15, 20 years ago," which really means I had an event that branded me neurologically and emotionally conditioned me, and I have been altered from that experience, and I haven't been able to change for the last 15 or 20 years. So then what most people do is, after they have that event, out of the infinite potentials in the quantum field, they begin to anticipate that it's going to happen again. And so they brace themselves for that event because they want to protect themselves and not be traumatized from the same event. So now they're selecting the worst case scenario, and they're emotionally embracing it, because in survival, if you focus on the worst thing that can happen, anything less that happens to you have better chances of
To
survival.
survive,
So
yes.
imagine the limited imagination we have when we're under stress, because we have to be prepared for the worst. And people spend the majority of their time bracing themselves for the worst things that could happen in their life. And
And because it's
that's,
familiar to them.
yeah, and because at least it means now they can focus on the knowns instead of the unknowns. And this is a challenge.
That's interesting. So number one is the belief in a divine intelligence that runs the body is greater than them. The other one is this whole idea of what you're talking about is to know and your thoughts contribute to your disease or your wellness. And if you know your thoughts contribute to your disease, you can use that same amount of knowledge to understand that that can be turned around to your thoughts contributing to your wellness. And that's the other one. All right, we're going to take another quick break and continue on with Dr. Joe Dispenza, and we'll continue on with the other traits of the intentional healing, and then we're going to get into some of Dr. Joe's advanced work, where his what he teaches in his advanced workshops, and we'll come back with that after the break. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.